Welcome to our 14th group session on practical work on self. Tonight we'll be talking about the chapter Thinking by Form, answering questions from the last class and moving on into remorse of conscience. And I'd like to remind everybody, if there's anyone online who hasn't gone to the website at positiveenergytools.com/PWOS and gotten on the mailing list, it's really great to be able to send class notifications and messages to you through that medium. So unless David has another thought, we had a question from last week from Guillermo from something that you brought up, David, and I would like to start there.
I'd like to just also emphasize the fact that the website is a place where we, as a group, we place our thoughts together for others to read as they start to get up to speed on this material. So it's really worth it to go. It's great to sign up. And if you can post something, that helps those coming after us. So I just also want to encourage everybody to sign up for the website.
That's great. I appreciate that point of view. And in fact, I'd like to start right before Guillermo's question with reading a comment from the website from last week by Mike Williamson, who's given us some great comments all along that will be there for people in the future. And his comment, in ordinary life, we cannot remember to awaken the machine because at first, when we don't yet know exactly how to awaken it, we try to awaken the machine with mental exertion. That's a quote. So what is mental exertion? What are the marks or clues in experience that indicates we are trying to use mental exertion to awaken the machine? What is the difference between the wind and water method and the use of mental exertion? Just as a suggestion, I would say that one is through whole body attention, receptively taking advantage of the waves of raw electrical energy that is given with each breath, while the way of mental exertion is more like Brer Rabbit trying to change Tar Baby.
Was that his answer?
Yes.
Very funny.
I thought everyone could enjoy that, especially those of us who are prone to excess thinking. So
it's like muscling your way into heaven.
Or forcing a rose to open with a crowbar. So, Guillermo, let's have your question.
Okay, the question was regarding the chapter of sensing, that there was a statement that says posture evokes mood. And I don't think you, David, mentioned that was an important part, and I don't remember having discussed that we talk about that.
So, posture evokes mood. David, did you have something to say about that?
Page 115 of Sensing.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah, you. Hey, you. Well, how would you determine whether there's any truth to that or not?
Well, is it? Can I say something about that?
Please.
Yeah, Matt. Yeah.
He's drawing you out.
Yeah. So, the grip that I have with that statement and the relation, I mean, my experience, is that the posture of your body. If you're laying down like that, you know, evoking, you know, the totally laziness and stuff like that, you know, and a posture of total relaxation, and not in a good way, I'll say. So like a sloth, something like that. That will trigger some kind of mood in me.
Ah.
If I put myself together, you know, like, okay, Guillermo, put yourself together, straight up back, you know, attent, alert, that posture will bring up a different attitude in my mind.
David's trying to do it while you're saying it.
Exactly. Well, that is the closest thing to an experience I have from that statement.
So if I'm sitting up real, my back is straight, and I'm just, my feet are on the ground, and I'm all right here, it's hard to evoke the mood of laziness right now.
I tend to believe that. Yeah, I have a bit of experience that it shows me
again,
in those lines.
But once again, we have another technique. And the technique is based on, if we're given to us, should we want to exercise our self-observation. So let's say that there's a mood that you find yourself in, or that we find ourselves in, that's useful or important. Maybe the mood has to be the mood of a certain kind of surrender to what's going on around you, so you can listen and look in a different way. And you notice that when you do that, notice the form that your body is in at that time. Notice various things. Like, for instance, this is not a simple exercise. Notice the facial muscles, for instance. We've done the exercise early on called dropping the facial mask. But you might notice that there's a whole symphony, in a sense, of posture that comes about when you are in a particular mood. Let's say that one of my long-time favorite moods is anger. So if I get into that, guess what? If I can notice it before it starts to manifest, because it has a whole series of postures that, in a sense, that mood demands. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So that means that experiencing, if I understand well, that means that in the time that an emotion such as anger or something like that, immediately the posture follows.
They go hand in hand.
The posture may precede also.
The posture starts to announce itself.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, it says, I'm on my way in. I'm coming.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can notice little parts of it that might be able to notice, then maybe we can shift directions at a certain point. Okay?
Got it.
So as a body worker, I actually have had a lot of experience with this. The body is exceptionally eloquent through posture, and there's a lot that an experienced person can read through the posture of another person in terms of their state. And also, posture can come from a lot of different sources. For instance, people who have habitual work, supposing they're pounding nails with a hammer all day on one side, or doing something where they're twisting all the time in one direction, the posture will completely change the state to a lesser or greater extent, of course. Or the posture may come from a woman with a large chest slumping in order to try and hide that a little bit, or from someone who has asthma trying to keep from coughing. Wherever that posture comes from, whether it comes from suppressed emotion or from physical causes like work use, the posture influences the experience of the individual quite a lot. And in fact, the muscles create what I call noise, energetic noise. It's like white noise into the whole system. So that white noise, in fact, activates the mind and makes the mind busier. And when someone receives good body work and the muscles are released, then the mood usually always changes along with the release of the muscles. And in addition to that, the mind becomes quieter. One of the main things that people enjoy about good body work is making the mind quieter that way. So in my experience, it's been posture is very important. In fact, I went to a workshop, and in that workshop, one thing that we did was to mold one another as if we were statues and to put the other person into a posture that expressed a mood that we were feeling on the inside so that we could see that mood on the outside and perhaps see what we would be looking like to other people if we fully expressed that mood through our body. So that's just some commentary on the way that posture can evoke mood. Now I have some comments also from Silverdale that I'd like to catch up with. Unless, David, did you have something you want to say? Okay. So Silverdale said posture is attitudinal, not physical in orientation. That is, one places one's attention on the vibratory sensation of the non-phenomenal self. This is a footnote by me as well. Some of us do, some of us may not. This posture influences the mood of the non-phenomenal self, which is highly indifferent or inclines toward pleasure, pleasant vibratory sensation. The definition of posture in the context of this chapter is related to the exact definition of sensing as originally indicated by Gurdjieff. So, Silverdale, since you're bringing up that exact definition, could you please refresh us on that? The definition of sensing is found on page 114 in Life is Only Real Then When I Am. Okay, I don't have that book in front of me. Do you have it in front of you? In the meantime, while he's looking for that, Guillermo, was that conversation useful for your question?
Yes, thank you, Teresa. Yes, thank you. That was a much, yeah, it's giving me more in the direction applied to this exercise. And yeah, it gave me light in the term and the phrase.
Good. The bottom line is that it doesn't really matter as much where the source of the posture originates, but as you begin in your self-observation, you can be to examine posture, you can see, you begin to see when a posture starts, how the posture is playing into the overall sensing that's going on in your body. The mood may start the posture, or the posture may start the mood, and there may be other elements, but it all starts to fit in there together, and you can influence any of it by almost any one of those starting points, depending on which one it's easier to get your hands around at that given moment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did we get the definition of sensing?
Not yet.
Well, you know, and I've just come back on the, do you have a moment to have me read just one paragraph?
Yes, that's what I was hoping for, because I think that there's a different angle to this whole posture thing also, but go ahead.
It is. This is from page 114 of the book, Life is Real Only Then When I Am. This is Gurdjieff speaking directly to the reader. In order to explain to you this very important question, the difference between sensing and feeling, I shall give you a corresponding definition. A man feels when what are called the initiative factors issue from one of the dispersed locations of his common presence, which in contemporary science are called the sympathetic nerve nodes, the chief agglomeration of which is known by the name of solar plexus, and the whole totality of which functioning, in the terminology long ago established by me, is called the feeling center. And he senses when the basis of his initiative factors is the totality of what are called the motor nerve nodes of the spinal and partly of the head brain, which is called, according to this terminology of mine, the moving center. So I'm not sure how much we can really get out of just that paragraph, since there's a lot of preparatory material that goes into what he has just said there. But
maybe the thought I had is also to consider your inner posture. Maybe to use that as a term as we're going through here. What is your inner posture?
Good.
Is inner posture the same thing as attitude?
I would agree with that, yes.
I think so. Does David think so?
I can see that as working. I'm worried a little bit about the term attitude as being feeling center in the way that Gurdjieff is using it there, that it could be somewhat mechanical, but for as a working definition, I guess it works for me. What's your attitude from a broad sense of the term attitude? Like, what attitude are you approaching the issue on?
Well, you know, the word posture and the word attitude are synonyms for one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
Diana?
It was Leona.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm just trying to get in on the conversation. I have done an exercise where the movement is so minute, and yet every part of my body goes into a defense mechanism. So it is like my body sensed, like the smaller the movement, the more that the defense, whatever you want to call it, comes up in the body. Now, that had nothing to do with attitude or nothing to do with thinking. It had to do with just the mechanical defense system that my body's in.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
It's an exercise from Feldenkrais. Which you move your little toe or your big toe about a quarter of an inch, and your whole body goes into a different kind of system, which is generally your defense system, where you don't see, you feel like you are standing straight, but you feel like you're standing crooked because you've changed the way that you normally posture yourself in a very minute way.
I've had that experience, too. Where are you going with that thought?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what you guys are talking about.
Well, no, she's just giving us an example. She's giving us an example of how the body posture change, just the physical body posture change, creates something in her.
Yeah, created awareness of posture that I did not have before I did that small, minute change.
Yep.
So really, posture can refer to two entirely different things, leading to two logical conclusions. One is the physical posture of the body can lead to a change in attitude. Just, you know, we can jump up in the air and suddenly feel happy, I suppose.
Yeah.
Or it can be an interior condition of posture or attitude that changes our mood.
I have this question. To you or whoever, I was talking to one of my yoga teachers, and they were explaining to me the difference between, let's say, yoga and martial arts versus weightlifting. That yoga and martial arts, you start building your muscles on the interior, and that eventually spreads out to the exterior, which is why a healthier, stronger body doesn't look the same way as, say, a bodybuilder, because a bodybuilder builds the exterior muscles so it looks better on the outside, but the interior isn't built. And I'm wondering if there's some correlation between that type of physical growth and our discussion here on posture and mood.
There is. In my experience, when people build up a lot of the exterior muscles and the obvious strength muscles without building up core support and core strength, they become more defensive, because if you think about it, it's the core strength that makes you feel supported in your body and supported on the inside, and any exercise that develops core strength tends to lend itself to feeling like you're supporting yourself and like you're stronger internally and less likely to need defense. You're more flexible. Making everything rigid on the outside and looking like a bouncer, you might be able to scare people, but you don't. The kind of strength that you have is a totally different kind of strength. It doesn't come from that same sense of security and ease that develops out of developing the core muscles.
That makes sense. Okay, thank you. Interesting.
So, can I say something?
Please.
So, that means if you feel like you're flighty or uneasy, then you can just a straightforward way to help yourself is to do some particular exercises to strengthen your core physically.
Yes, that can happen, but that's then we're beginning to drift away, I think, from the practical work on self-focus. So in the practical work on self-focus is more a matter of using those experiences for very detailed and being very attentive to self-observation and beginning to sense into your moments and to see how your experience is arising.
I see.
So if there's no more questions or comments on that, okay, here's Zazen saying something. I was thinking we'd move into thinking by form. Zazen, in an earlier talk, I heard Monk call smiling mouth yoga. At the time, he asked, which came first, the smile or happiness? Sweet.
Funny.
Okay, so David, are you ready to move into thinking by form?
Yeah.
All right, I'll read the header. A being who has fallen into identification with the sleep of the machine is forced to involuntarily accept impressions from every source. Impartial man is able to categorically select impressions.
What was the exercise on this chapter? Does anybody remember?
Yeah, I do.
Good.
Did you write it down, David?
No, I just forgot.
You want to put it on your list, though. Okay, please tell us.
As I understood, the exercise was to see, for instance, a written word or something, and not jump right away into the message that immediately would convey it in our heads when we read something or we look at something. but to look at things as or words as if we were illiterate, as if we didn't understand exactly what it was, like a drawing, perhaps a group of lines. And in the way that I practiced it was that to look at things with new eyes.
Nice description.
Like
thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Like look. Sorry. Yeah, it was like that. It was like things don't change. Things don't have to change in the outside. You have to change how you look at things. And so when I the exercise that I did that, and I guess that's why EJ says there, look at what you're looking at, or if it is a written word or something, in the way as if you were illiterate. Don't let the message come right away. Oh, it means that. Oh, that's what it is. So change your perspective of how do you read or look at something out of indoctrination.
Intentional illiteracy.
Exactly.
So I was wondering if anybody had a chance to try to practice that. Guillermo said that he was able to. Did anybody else try it?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Any thoughts or how'd it go?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I actually was talking to somebody who had said that they were, that they got into a conversation with someone and that person had told them that they repulsed them. So when I heard that, I had a reaction to somebody saying to somebody else, you repulse me. And so I took the word repulse and decided I didn't know what it meant.
Okay.
And I took the word pulse and went with the word pulse and transformed the word for myself. So, I mean, yeah, so it was, it moved me from, it shifted this whole thing about my reaction to the word repulsed.
That's actually a pretty accurate word. Is.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I mean, pulse and then repulse. That person repulsed the other person.
Yeah, but like pulse is about life.
There you go.
And then the pulse bounces back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, what was your experience for trying to stay in the place of I don't know what it means?
My mind wanted to make another meaning, which it did right away.
Yeah, and that's the thing to catch, is that. Yep. It's hard to stay in the place of I don't know. And I was reading some, I was actually reading some a column of numbers that Diana can appreciate that task at times is unusual. So I'm staring at this, and the numbers seemed incredibly wrong, way off. And I started being concerned about that and trying to figure it out and all this stuff. And then I looked at it again, and I had misread it significantly. So my eyes scanned over the darn thing, and I assumed I knew what I meant right away and just went on, right? So then I realized that, my gosh, I wasn't even looking at what was in front of me. So then I turned my gaze on it again and actually focused attention on it, and I found that it was very hard to do because it was like my attention, like this part of the brain wanted to just skim through it and get quick answers as to what was in front of me. Mm-hmm. It was an odd sensation.
I wanted to point out that, Leona, what you did is interesting in as much as, well, the exercise was with the written word, you did it with the spoken word. And I've had that same experience before, well, my version of it, where I hear a word and sometimes it'll just, I'll take that word, whether it's written or spoken, and keep turning the same word around in my mouth and listening to it in my mouth or my head and repeating it until the word has no meaning anymore. And I begin to wonder how the word ever really had a meaning, and then I begin to wonder whether I had just made the word up in the first place, and then I realize it's a word that's in common use.
Mm-hmm. Totally. You have experienced that too, Teresa. Yeah, that's exactly, it's another way.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It's very, very interesting. You
what
keep
do
repeating
you
the word and it loses the meaning.
What do you feel when that happens, Guillermo?
It makes so ridiculous. The word looks so ridiculous.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh at the word. I say, wow, how did they come out with that sound for
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. And you're going, how does anybody think this means anything? And then you realize
right,
that
right.
None of it really does, that we just, it's just a convention. We just decided that it meant something together, you know? It's just this
right.
sound.
So we've all had a similar experience to that. So how do we relate that to the exercise that may be intended in this particular chapter, then, chapter 13? What is EJ trying to guide us to see at that moment?
Well, we're thinking about that, I'll add Zazen's comment. Looking at signs on the street and words in books, when I could perform the exercise, I stopped as I noticed the sign or word, noticing shape and color, and then the phrase, what is this? Or does this mean, appeared in my thoughts, shortly following information gathered such as definitions, images, etc.
Okay.
Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
You can read another language and not understand what it means, and you know it's a word. There's something here that I'm not really, really catching, and it has to me. It has to do with the root of words, like either traditionally or like I take things in traditionally and say I take things in culturally and religiously or whatever, however I take in a meaning, like the meaning of the word is, I think, what I want to let go of. Like the meaning behind the meaning.
If I may, that's getting a little bit closer to it. I think what the author is trying to guide us to is saying that is to see the moment where we automatically are just going into that acquiescence of the meaning. It just happens automatically. And EJ is trying to say there's a moment before that occurs. There's just a moment before that occurs. Can you grab that moment just before it occurs, and where is that coming from in you? And are we then working to, in a sense, separate like this, pull them apart, separate those two worlds? Because there's a way of reading a document or reading something where we are actively engaged in it, actively engaged in that process of looking at something, reading something, and hearing something. What a great example that was. When we automatically just go for it. We fall asleep, in a sense, to the fact, oh, I already know this. And think of that when we're dealing with our acquaintances or friends or this individual that was repulsed. And they look at somebody, they automatically know what it meant, What if you paused, and I'm talking about microseconds in a certain way, and you didn't know what that meant right away?
Or maybe even expanding the time between those moments. There's a way that when we bring our attention to bear in those moments, it's almost like the time telescopes, and we
Absolutely.
Have a little more space there. And that's a very important thing to be able to do that I think speaks to a lot of this.
Yeah, our goal is not so what you are active at that point, and you're active, we are active or attempting to be active in applying our attention, and we apply the attention and something different happens at that moment. So when you're trying to be intentional, when you're practicing intentional illiteracy, what a unique exercise, isn't it, for us?
This is fantastic. I was just going to mention to you, you know what it brings this to me? Remember, I don't know, I'm going to bring a different angle of teachings here, but is what Don Juan used to say to Carlos, not
yeah.
doing?
Yeah. That,
the not doing. Because when we interpret something, when we get the meaning right away, is because we are doing.
Well, yeah.
So the mythic natives, Don Juan, used to say, well, don't do it. Those were the exercise of not doing, to stop the conditioning.
Good.
There's another exercise or two exercises, very simple, like to listen to the space between the words, or in music, the space between the notes, or in vision, to focus for an hour or a day on the shadows rather than, or the spaces between things rather than on the objects. And that's a similar way of relocating attention and expanding it. Zazen said, I feel an opening rather than a closing of my attention.
There you go.
And this is from where, Teresa?
I can't remember.
Okay. It's coming out of you just automatically, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
I believe it came from a book on sight and on learning to work with the eyes in ways that improved vision, although I've seen similar exercises in different places before. There's a way that one can, there's a difference between looking and seeing, and looking being more active and seeing being more open, where you allow the images to come into you rather than going out to the images. When you go out to the images, you're bringing perhaps your interpretation or your intention into it. And when you're still within yourself and allowing the images to enter you, then you're moved by them differently, perhaps in a less mental way.
Once again, I just want to emphasize our goal here isn't necessarily in the exercises here so that we feel better about what's going on around us or anything. The goal is to try to see this crack in the cosmic egg, so to speak, and to notice those two different methods of viewing the world, and the embryo is the attention that we put on it. So there you have it. we still here?
Yep.
Hello? Yeah.
Okay. So how are we doing on chapter 13 and
how about moving on to the next one?
Move on to the next one, okay.
Okay, now if we're going to move on to the next one, I'd suggest, if possible, to do a tape change now so we're not interrupted in the middle of it. Any possibility of that?
Not on this end. Marvette's not here at the moment, so she'll be here in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
But if it works for you, we can